This is Rough Addicts After Hours.
Welcome, ladies and jelly spoons. Episode 57, Rack Addicts After Hours. Just Pete and I today. We're on Zoom. And all Pete can really see of me is... what's that? That's going to be my right eye, probably, as I'm currently hiding under a makeshift vocal booth made out of a tripod, mic stand, and a duvet, just to avoid the horrifying echo.
It's an interesting look. It's a very interesting look. I'm not sure what I'm seeing.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a fashion for YouTube podcast personalities. There's just going to be duvet tents everywhere. And it's getting warm. It's heating up.
It's like some apparition. I'm really uncertain about what it's all about.
hopefully a Shure SM7B is in my future soonish.
And, I'm not sure that's going to help with the reverb in the room. I mean, I'm going to have to hit it hard with the RX8.
It might do a teeny tiny amount if it's a little bit less sensitive, but either way, we do this so often, I might as well do it properly. So acoustic treatment, reflection filter should be in the future. Anyway, we've got a huge synthy news type thing, even though last episode I think we said, oh yeah, there's not really going to be a NAMM. Feels like there is. There's synths pouring out of our ears. So, David, once again, you're in for a treat. But before we jump into that, what have you been up to recently, Pete?
Well, as I was explaining earlier, I've been on the hunt for weevils. We've had a weevil infestation.
And, didn't even realise it could be a thing, but here we are.
No, weevil infestations. Apparently they're very rare. I mean, how it transpired, and a bit of advice for anyone out there on the internet, don't ever take birdseed into your home, or certainly not into your bedroom, as my daughter did, because apparently birdseed invariably or can be infested with weevil larvae, and you take them into a centrally heated home and they think it's summer and they burst forth.
They begin
and swarm and all that type of thing, if you can say. Well, they're tiny little beetle type creatures with little horns. Well,
I think they're a pretty global pest, aren't they? Everybody should be vaguely familiar with weevils.
I had visions of 18th century seamen tapping their biscuits before they consume them to knock the weevils out.
In your future.
They were mainly concentrated in their in the sort of plastic bag that the birdseed was in, but they had managed to eat their way through and were kind of, some of them were trying to migrate to the rest of the house, which was a bit alarming. As I say, they're relatively innocuous in their own right. They don't bite or do anything like that, but if they can find any sort of certain, you know, dry foods or anything like that, they have a propensity to infest them and eat them and then lay more larvae in. God knows where we would be. Anyway, we've dealt with it, but it was a bit intense at the time.
Never thought intense and weevils could occupy the same sentence.
Certainly.
Right. Actually, I was going to say, have I been up to anything at all recently? But I have. I've been digging back into Blender, which I may have mentioned many months ago, but I've finally got a proper start on there. So, done a little bit of basic modelling, got some very, very basic shading in there, a little bit of physics, some rigid bodies, some animations. It seems like such a vast program to learn. I think I'm understanding what it feels like for people who've never touched a DAW before. You know, so many buttons and so many processes that we don't understand. But it's nice to start at the beginning again.
Yeah, Blender's certainly one of those programs I keep sort of promising myself that I should sort of have a dabble with it, especially as it's essentially free, isn't it?
Yeah, I think there might be some paid plugins potentially, and of course you can pay all you want for texture packs and all this kind of stuff for your own modeling. But yeah, it's free and you can make some serious stuff out of it.
Yeah, I mean, there's quite a fraternity. I have seen that they have not recently, obviously, with the current situation, but they certainly have Blender conferences, and they various developers talk about what they've achieved with it and what they're doing. But it's like so many of those things, you really have to apply yourself if you're going to get anywhere with it. But then I think that goes for any serious 3D package, graphic or animation package.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, being open source software and fundamentally a creative tool, it does have quite a nice intersection of the technical and the artsy, where I don't imagine anybody that comes from a pure art kind of standpoint would really enjoy working with it unless they were really driven and to brute force it. But the more technically minded, who are also arty, would probably take to it like ducks to water, as the phrase goes. I did make a Rubik's Cube. That's all I've really managed. Rubik's Cube and a lightsaber. But I will update if there's anything exciting on the horizon. We better jump into the main section, synth news. There's a hell of a lot of it this week. So maybe it is, Nam, maybe it is. In my little notes tabs of news, it seems like there's a bit of a Korg overload. Should we tackle that first, Pete?
Yeah, it looks like they Korg seriously did take a dump on the internet this week.
Absolutely. What's the highlight for you?
Well, it's one of the more obscure ones that I thought was interesting. Obviously, we'll cover all the individual items, but it was the Wave State Special Edition.
Yeah, so is there anything other than just being 61 keys now?
I think it's got Aftertouch.
Which huge.
Is, yes, exactly.
Especially
very
for Korg.
Yes, especially for Korg. But no, it's got a sort of a pro feel to it. So I think physically it's going to sort of be a bit more like the Prolog 16 or even larger, and it's a metal faced and
encoders
and the knobs are all not all metal, but there's metal knobs. It just looks a lot better built. I mean, I've got nothing against the Wave State.
Great.
I mean, I quite like the very lightweight, but as I've said before in previous podcasts, it's like picking up a sheet of paper or several sheets of paper. There's nothing to it. So I think they've just given it some real heft and a serious key bed.
Definitely. I mean, we've said before, it's so deep. It does seem a lot more, like you say, pro compared to some of the others in that lightweight, small plastic chassis series. And speaking of which, there's going to be a new entrant into that range. So we've had the first Wave State. We've had the Op 6, the FM version. Mod Wave now. So it is just the three, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, so Modwave, Wavetable, Synthesis Powerhouse. That's the plan. And they say inspired by the DW8000. Though I imagine there'll be quite a modernising to be had here. Certainly looks pretty cool. It'll be interesting to see what the user experience is like. Well, it can't be it can't be too similar to the Wave State because nothing is. But I'm interested by that touchpad on the top left. A bit of a Chaos Pad kind of vibe going on there.
Notably, it's a bit more expensive than its two predecessors, i.e. the Wave State and the Op 6. Got a UK price of £699.
Oh, yeah.
So I can only imagine that the increased cost is to do with the larger amount of control surface. It's not the physical surface isn't bigger, but there's a lot more controls. And as you say, you've got the Chaos Pad in there as well.
Yeah.
So I just think these elements always add more cost to any keyboard or device.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying what Korg's doing these days. I mean, much more enthused by that company.
Yeah, no, I know what you're saying in that respect. You get the impression they're really they're trying quite hard. You know, they're putting a bit of effort into it.
Definitely, more exciting than what Roland's coming out with these days.
Yeah, unfortunately, Roland hasn't done anything for quite some time. I can't remember last time Roland actually did something that I was relatively excited about. It's a good maybe 10 years, maybe longer than that even.
I think overall, I quite like the boutiques as an idea, but things like the SEO2 and not giving six-voice polyphony, though they did say that was an expenses-type thing, to some of the other ones. A lot of them were kind of poorly executed, I found.
As I've said many times, the SEO2, it was a size thing, and obviously they were keeping to the boutique format. But I've always thought that if they had the same, exactly the same synth in a kind of 19-inch rack with full-size knobs, it would have been quite an interesting proposition.
And that would actually, I suppose it was done with Studio Electronics, and they do have those sort of mini Moog or mini Moog, I guess, souped up, upgraded things that I can never remember the name of that come in that 19-inch rack format. Maybe they didn't want to potentially compete with Studio Electronics' own offering, in a sense.
Or possibly, or just that it was the fact that the brief was that we need
this form factor.
It needs to be in this format and this scale.
Yeah.
Who knows what conversations happened between the two organisations.
Yeah, we may never know. All we do know is that it's kind of a shame. But still on the Korg front, before we jump into the two vintage-flavoured ones, the drum log, which, I mean, it may well be part of the log range using the NTS-1 mini-log-style multi-engine. Not massively keen on the name, if I'm honest. But, you know, hybrids, grooveboxy drum machine kind of thing, potentially a cool idea. Though if you look at the first look on their YouTube channel, if you give it a listen, does not sound very exciting at all. Have you had a listen, Pete?
Yeah, it was very difficult to tell exactly what was going on, and it wasn't explained. It was only in the prototype stage, so it was just a bit of a teaser, really. I think we've just got to be patient and wait and see a proper finished product. Good listen. I would imagine once they got it going, they'll farm it out to various sound designers and so forth. And
yeah, it'd be great if they retained the open source nature of the multi-engine, since there's been some really interesting stuff, like people porting the mutable instruments oscillators, sample support is available on there, some quite cool stuff. So if it has a lot of that, could potentially be quite interesting, but as you say, we should wait.
Yeah, see what they turn up with.
Definitely. Over to the vintage flavoured things. Mini Korg 700FS. We'll overlook that one for now because I know you have thoughts on it, Pete. But we did know this was coming. The ARP 2600, but small, the small sized one. Are they all going to come with the fancy nice case, or is it just the first few?
No, I think this is it. It comes. It is a genuine, complete mini me. So it's looks like it's been made to the same sort of manufacturing standards, and it comes in the case. And I'm sure that's, you know, they've got to do that really to justify this price, I suppose. Initially, when I sort of first caught a glance of the announcement, I thought it was going to be a little sort of plastic mini me, like the MS-20 mini. Sort of a much reduced in size. And I think, isn't the MS-20 Mini about the same sort of scale, isn't it? About 60... Is this 60% of the size, I believe?
The 2600 is 60%. I don't know off the top of my noggin about the MS-20, and I've never met a real one, so I can't eyeball it either.
They're not massively much bigger, except obviously they've got full-size keys. But
and they're quarter-inch patch cables as well.
And quarter-inch patch cables as well. But it's not phenomenally much bigger, so I would imagine the proportion's about the same size. But obviously, the original is steel construction with plastic sort of ends. I wouldn't say end cheeks; it's more like big sides.
Yeah,
sort of frame, quite a tall thing. But the MS-20 Mini is plastic all through and through, isn't it? And it's quite lightweight when you pick
them up. It's lightweight. It doesn't especially feel, you know, cheap and that it will fall apart like certain bee flavored things, but you know, it's fine, does the job.
But and this is my initial perception of what this was, but now looking at it, it looks like it's been quite well crafted. I mean, it's just smaller. I'm not sure about it though. I mean, I'm sure it's a very nice thing, but unfortunately,
big
obviously
time
with
the money
because of the Behringer just about to be upon us. And then the subsequent announcement of the Blue Marvin and the Grey Mini, which actually are quite interesting propositions, and still only £100 more than the current version that they're releasing or will be available in the next couple of weeks, wouldn't it?
I think it was early February, if I remember rightly. I actually did have a couple of customers ask about these at work today. So yeah, if you haven't seen these, Behringer's ARP 2600 is coming soon, but they've also announced that they're going to do Blue Marvin and Grey Mini versions. Now, Pete, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but my impression is that they were two earlier versions of the 2600s, different colours. They also had different filter types, which were changed for legal reasons. Am I right?
Possibly. I'm not sure of the history. The only part of the history I'm aware of, and only because I watch some other YouTube commentators on it, was that these were... I don't know if they were special editions. They were certainly, they're certainly quite rare. Apparently, they're very rare. But also, the originals were also slightly problematic. They were had some issues, technically. But according to the Behringer video that I watched, they were stating that these ones have upgraded components, so they're higher quality components than the initial release. And they've also got a spring reverb. And my perception, rightly or wrongly, was the one that's been released has got some sort of digital reverb in it.
Yeah, I think a lot of the people that were asking about these today were going, oh, actually, let me wait a bit longer. Let's have the other one. Yeah, I know, but the grey one does certainly look really nice to me.
Yeah, there's a very few Behringer products that I'm that excited about or that keen on. But I think you're right. The grey one, it's quite interesting. You think it actually looks quite tasteful. And as I say, if it's completely analog with a spring reverb, there's a half a chance it's going to be quite reliable if they've done it things properly, which they
definitely hopefully have. You should have heard us speak before about our experience with Behringer's falling apart, but we'll have to wait for them to arrive in the shop so we can get our greasy mitts on them, hopefully soon.
I don't know how long we're going to have to wait for these. There didn't seem to be any indication.
No date, yeah.
We haven't got them on order, as far as I'm aware. I don't think we've got
them
on the
system. No, we don't. We will do as soon as we can, of course, but we'll see. We'll see how that goes.
So with all this, with the one that's coming out, these following along, I think to a degree, this is going to stifle it somewhat for Korg. I mean, if Korg had done this a couple of years ago, I think they could have got in there and made their mark, but
done all the classics around the same time as the MS-20 and their Odyssey.
So you can either have a blue Marvin or a grey Mini at $699, or you can spend another £1,000 and get the Korg,
the official in inverted commas.
So I mean, I would rather spend the extra more, not that they are any, and get a full size one.
Yeah, if you're going the Korg way, I mean. It's how much was it if you wanted, apart from the fact that you can't get hold of...
It was 3.7, wasn't it?
Yeah, so my mental maths is terrible, but you could have, you know, 4, 5, maybe 6 of the Behringer ones for the same cost.
Well, at the point being, especially as it was only 150 worldwide of the full-size one, was that people were doubling up. I mean, I certainly saw people were reselling them for almost double that figure. So it's a bit
classic
like getting a car, a limited issue or a particular sports car, you know, with a 2-year waiting list. People at the head of the waiting list, as soon as they get them, they can flip them and make a tidy little profit.
Yeah, so for the impatient could, further in the back.
Yeah, certainly. So you could either, certainly with these, you could get one, maybe enjoy it for a little while and then make a decision. You either flip it and sort of almost double your money or just hang on to it. I don't see it particularly losing any value.
No, it could be a good investment and definitely a quality item. The next thing we should definitely talk about is probably a quality item, but maybe less valuable. Pete, you have thoughts on this. Do you want to take it away?
I mean, when I was asked, because I was actually off at the time, but I got an email when we got sort of a heads up before or just around the time that Korgan made these announcements, and my opinion was sought in respect to how many do you think we should buy or order in. And I'm always very conservative with these sort of things. I mean, in that respect, and I couldn't really think of the sort of mini Korg 700S being I don't recall it being a synth that people were lusting after. I mean, I know that subsequently I watched the Sonic State video and they were talking about it being on a couple of I think Tom York had used it on an album, and I think they might have said Goldfrapp, but there was certainly a couple of artists that it stated they used it, and it was sort of a known synth, but I wasn't particularly aware of it, and having sort of been quite into synths for the last 40 years, that I think that says something. I mean, we're talking literally, it's a 48-year-old synth. I mean, 1973.
Oof.
So quite primitive. And
that
I also
has double my age.
And I also had a little look around and realised that as a second-hand item, they're on. Well, there was one on eBay and it was in functioning condition and it was going for $1,000. So you can either get an original one for $1,000, or one of these reproductions for a good proportion of $2,000. $17.99, I should say, more accurately. And yes, obviously it's new, and yes, there are some. I think there's some. They've added some preset functionality. It's very subtle what they've added, but the aesthetic exactly the same. And yes, it does come in a kind of classic old fashioned like suitcase type. I won't describe it as a flight case.
It literally looks like a suitcase.
Old school suitcase. I mean, I'm sure it's a nice thing, but I certainly could think of. Much better ways to spending that sort of money on a synth, or a better synth to spend that money on.
it's pretty mad. I mean, to its defense, I do really like, even if it's not a return to the format because nobody cares about this particular feature anymore, but to see something in production that's of the format where it would sit atop an organ or potentially a Fender Rhodes or something with that controls on the front underneath the keys, that kind of look, there's something quite pleasing about it. It's a strange oblong thing. I do quite like that. But you had a look at the video, and sound wasn't exactly impressive, you say.
Well, not what I heard. I mean, it may be capable of doing things, but if you look at the control functionality, it's very limited. I mean, there is a strange there's a thing that apparently you can get the high and low filters to sort of pass each other. If you take the knobs off, they'll actually go and cross right over, and I assume you get nothing at all at that stage. You can sort of hone in on a particular frequency to a very tight degree. But I wasn't greatly impressed by there was a Japanese gentleman playing. I assume it was an original one, and no, it wasn't for me. And notably, it's a synth that it doesn't look like Behringer decided to copy. I mean, that must be saying so.
Totally. I mean, this morning you described it as sounding like a box of bees, so that's not exactly the glowing endorsement.
Yes. I mean, I'm sure a lot of synths are capable of sounding quite good, especially if you whack them through some nice effects processing and so forth.
But you have to have a lot of effects to save this one.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, it's definitely not my cup of tea, and certainly not at that price. I mean, I would imagine collectors, people who like this type of thing, would potentially buy it. I did have a quick look. I think we've already got some pre-orders for them, but it's definitely not for me. I'm not really into this sort of super retro thing. It's a bit like the Prophet 5. I mean, as I say, it's a symptom sort of 40-odd years ago. That's practically exactly the same design, all bar the odd addition like MIDI and USB. You know, other than those two conceits, you know, they're absolutely original. I mean, this goes to the crux of my point that I was trying to make about the difference between the Prophet 5 and the Prophet 6. The Prophet 6 is the culmination of Dave Smith's experience over 40 years. It's the pinnacle, and then to sort of leapfrog that with the original thing from way back. I know it's got a certain tonality, but why would it be better than something that's 40 years newer?
Yeah, I spoke to a customer today who is one of his first proper synths, where he had a Prophet 6 desktop and he just had some issues with tuning. Just advised him about the calibration, but I did pass on your thoughts on the matter. I said, if you do look at the Prophet 5 and potentially have buyer's remorse, do remember that my colleague and I, we think you made the right decision.
Yeah,
it's those effects more mileage.
Had he gone for the Prophet 6?
Absolutely, desktop module. It's a good buy.
Yeah, I can't imagine anyone being disappointed after getting a Prophet 6. You just can't be. It's great.
Extra voice effects, and more control. I've definitely
heard people do sort of A/Bs and get the Prophet 6 sounding like the Prophet 5. You know, really quite sound. I know that it's intrinsically there's quite a few differences, but in my mind the Prophet 6 can do so. There's so much more modulation opportunities. There's the effects, there's the distortion, there's so much more there.
Yeah.
I know there's some subtleties that the Prophet 5 can do, but they aren't that exciting. As I say, I go back to the vintage knob, you know, the slop. I know the slop applies to the envelopes as well as the oscillators. But, you know, there is a slop on the Prophet 6, only for the oscillators.
Totally. I mean, it looks like our advice could be summed up as curb your vintage fetishes, I think. That would be the way.
I mean, I can see the thing. If you had the money and you could sort of buy one of these, you know, a Model D, one of the ones that Moog issued a few years ago, and then you can buy the Prophet 5, and then you can get a full-sized MS-20, and now you can get this, and you could build up a nice collection of future retro type of synth. They're all new, but they're all old.
Yeah.
I can see there could be a sort of subtle pleasure in that. I can see that being a thing. But as I say, I always prefer the latest incarnation. You know, I'd much rather have a sort of a Moog Voyager than a Model D. Because, you know, I'd much rather have a Prophet 6 than a Prophet 5. I'm just trying to think of some others that, you know, but you can see what I'm saying.
Would not want a Polymoog. Although, would you want a Moog 1 either?
No, I wouldn't want a Moog 1 either. But that's a whole other can of worms, isn't it?
Totally. While we're still in the vintage flavour, two more that I've got to throw out there. One being a small nugget of vague rumour mongering. Recently, there's nothing official on this at the moment, but on January the 5th this year, Sequential filed a trademark for OBX for use with musical instruments. So potentially a reissue in the works there on the Oberheim flavour as well.
Yeah, so I'd heard that that rumour circulating, so that would be interesting to watch. Someone had put up a graphic, so I don't know if it was an original Oberheim, and that inspired me to have a quick look on Tom Oberheim's website, and I have to say there was nothing there, not even the two voices that were used to be listed.
Oh, interesting.
The only thing currently on his website is the OB6, and then sort of links going back to Dave Smith. So he looks like Tom is completely inactive now. I mean, he's quite an elderly gentleman. So, but I mean, as I say, up to recently there was two voices available for purchase, and then a few years ago, and he did demonstrate it over a couple of trade shows over a couple of years. He was threatening to do some modular, but that never came to pass.
Yeah, bit of a shame. One thing that's very nice if you're in our line of work or potentially synth repair and you've had an OB6 from Sequential open, you'll find that on the voice cards there is a little Tom Oberheim signature on the PCB, which is a nice little flavour to see.
Yeah, they just look like memory dims, don't they? They fit into dim
very
sockets.
Similar to RAM. It's very nice.
Yeah, well, that's the whole thing. As I always say, that when you see these old synths being opened up and there's literally a sort of spaghetti of cables and it's great big large, and you open a modern one up and there's a motherboard and some maybe very small little modules, and that's it. It's mostly fresh air.
Yeah, definitely. There's lots of space for the weevils to hide. Let's jump into another Behringer one, if we may. The Prophet 600 alike, the Pro 800 from Behringer. There's a video on that, which is definitely worth checking out.
Certainly sounds good. It's interesting that they've got a polyphonic synth in that format. I think it's slightly longer, so Behringer have got the two sort of width. I don't know how many HPs you could call them, but you had the sort of Model D sort of width, and then I think is it the K2 is
K2 and the Neutron, the wider ones, yeah.
So I think it's on the same scale as the sort of K2 and Neutron. It seemed to be that sort of size, and it's a two-layer card, and I think most of the other ones are just a single-layer card.
Oh yeah, I've had my Neutron open, and it's one layer.
Yeah, so they've managed to get two cards in there, and then one of the lower card is just all voices.
Yeah, nice.
So all eight voices. So they packed quite a lot in. And obviously you've got the addition of USB and MIDI and a sort of wipe clean touch control panel to the left so that you can program it. So I'm wondering how much they've got. I'm assuming they've got sort of presets possibly.
Yeah, I mean, there's a little 8-part, 7-segment display kind of thing going on next to that touch plate kind of control panel. It could definitely be great because their clones of the analog circuitry have been pretty reliable. As we mentioned earlier in this same podcast, actually, the digital stuff is concerning. So we'll have to see what happens when those arrive on shores unknown somewhere at some point. But I want to keep my eye on this. I really, really enjoyed the Pro 2 clone. Wait, no, the Pro 1 clone that they did. I think that sounds really nice.
But you did say that you had an indication of price was quite dramatic for Behringer.
I've seen $599.
Yeah, so that normally translates to £599. So £600, not out the way, but considering that's more expensive than a DeepMind 12, which is, as I say, a full-size keyboard.
Oh, wait,
keybed.
Is it more than a 12? Oh, okay, that changes my opinion slightly.
Yeah, DeepMind 12, I'm sure they're around, I could be wrong, could be 649. I keep getting my numbers all over the place.
Let me having said that,
the DeepMind was north of £900 when I've got one of the early ones. So it's quite expensive initially, and it's only in the last couple of years that it's gotten back to this kind of, I wouldn't say bargain basement price, but really sort of affordable price. I mean, you know how many times...
659 in most places, it looks like.
So, obviously, you know how many times I recommend the DeepMind to customers. The amount of DeepMinds I've sold just by... introducing a customer to it and how it sounds, and it's a sort of another one of these synths that sells itself.
Yeah, definitely. Actually, a quick aside: what else do you think sells itself that we deal with anyway?
It's a difficult call because everyone you play, people come in and they play the Prophet 6 and the OB6 and they would like it, but the price, you know, we're currently in the UK around £2,400.
Yeah, couple of big ones.
That's a lot of money for the average person who's looking to buy a synth, especially if it's their first synth. But if you sort of turn around and show them either a DeepMind 12 or if they're slightly more on a budget-conscious sort of purchase, the DeepMind 6, which is exactly the same other than the lack of six-note polyphony and the smaller keybed. But essentially, it's the same. So, you know, the amount of those I've shifted by, you know, they're disappointed in the respect that they can't afford one of the excessive two grand synths. But you show them that, and it's well within their budget, and it's a lot more synth than something like a mini log. Even the mini log XD, I think I'd still go for the DeepMind. I know it's got the multi engine in it. But. The only other thing that I would show someone now would be a Wavestate because that's quite affordable and it's a lot of fun.
It's a totally different side to the coin that may appeal to some people more than others.
Yeah, I mean, it's got a synthesis elements, but it's completely digital. But the actual quality of the what you can produce from it and the complexity of what you can produce of it, because you can have four layers, which is very appealing. So that's I think that sells itself. I haven't. To be honest, because of where we've mostly been in lockdown, I haven't had the opportunity to demonstrate a Wavestate to a customer. But it's another one that I will, when we hopefully get back to some semblance of normality and we have customers perusing equipment in a normal fashion, I will be pointing that one out on a regular basis.
Definitely. Well, let's jump into the modular world because there are a few bits that have caught my eye. The guitarists amongst you, or the pedal enthusiasts, may know PolyEffects. They have two options, the Bebo and Digit, which are time-based effects and modulation-based effects. No idea which way around they are, to be honest, Bebo or Digit. From our colleagues at work, potentially fine, good bit of money. But they've jumped into the Eurorack world as well with something called Hector. What a noble English name, Hector, in Eurorack format, which combines both of their pedals into a touchscreen large format. It's another one of the modular within a modular options, much like the Empress Effects Zoya. Empress Audio Zoya, and whatever its equivalent was called. I can't remember off the top of my head, but they have a Eurorack version as well. Though this PolyEffects version is pretty much just effects processor rather than, on the Zoya side, actually a full-on synth in its own right. An interesting one. We'll see how it goes. I can't see it being massively popular. Again, things like the Percussor Super Signal Processor, the Zoya and its Eurorack format, there's a market for them. I think the leader in that category would be the Orthogonal Devices sound computer. I think that's the ER301. Do you know that one, Pete?
No, I'm not over familiar with that unit.
It's very expensive, quite difficult to get your hands on, but it's got a bit of a cult following, that one. But it's, you know, flexible modular within a modular type thing. I think it's definitely leading that category still. Polyeffects Hector, if you're into that kind of thing, you just want really flexible effects, could be worth a look. Not out yet, but it's likely going to be £500 plus, so, you know, big premium module thing. Another one for the Rumour Engine. We don't have details. We have sort of a sound demo, which I didn't really guess much from. But Make Noise, coming out with a new experimental sound design-y something with Alessandro Cortini. Nothing really to go on. We've got a picture of a panel, kind of, which says activation. There's something that says tones. As usual with Make Noise stuff, it can be very difficult to try and figure out what on earth is going on from the panel. There's a filter involved, maybe. There's LEDs, it's black and gold, it's jagged, it's white, it's probably going to be amazing. Don't have much to say, but go and check out the demos. Or sneak peeks, more likely. But we'll see. And do give us a shout on Facebook, at RackAddictsUK, to cast your votes, see what you think this one might be. Don't even know what it's called yet. Last one. ADAC, or ADAC, or ADAC, I don't know. I believe they're a French company. ADAC System. They've got a really big module, and another entry into the granulary, loopery, recording-y, effects processory something. This one's called the 112 Voltage-Controlled Looper and Granular Sampler. I couldn't find any proper demos of this yet, but looking at the control panel, it's all quite spread out, quite hands-on, pretty comprehensive, it's looking like. You've got sort of three sections, looper engine, granular engine, and sort of a whole mix section. So really comprehensive and very fine control if you really want to get into your granular. Stereo, digital stuff, so 16-bit 44.1, comes with a separate sort of breakout module, which is where all the jacks and patch panel stuff is. So it's quite a nice format, having all of the controls and where your hands want to be in one place. And I imagine it'll be just a ribbon cable, so you can relocate the jacks to somewhere out of the way and potentially more convenient. I'll wait for DivKid's opinion on it, because we do trust him. We love his demos. But there we go. ADAC VC112, if you want more granular looping action. Is that it for synth news? Have we missed anything?
Well, there's one last thing. Let's drag ourselves back to the Korg announcements. I thought this was quite amusing, which was the Korg Gadget VR.
I don't know VR, if you caught that. Korg Gadget. I didn't catch that one. Tell me about it.
So, I don't know if you're familiar with Korg Gadgets. They're sort of stripped-down versions of their sort of... I don't know if they're those classic Korg collection items. I mean, I've got one which is a kind of stripped-down Electrotribe on my iPad, or one of my iPads. Mm. And I think it's that type of thing, but it's in VR. So they've got a number of... There was quite a lot of units. I think it looked like there was... I don't know, but 15 or 20 different units, and you can have them arrange on a virtual desk in front of you, and then they have all sorts of sort of sequencing windows that are kind of spaced around you, which look like they might apply to the units, but you can actually pick the units up and twiddle the knobs.
That's really cool. I mean, what formats can you have it on? Are you going to be able to have a go?
I don't know. I didn't know what platform. I would imagine it's a good chance it were coming out on the Oculus Quest, because that's one of the most popular headsets that's in availability. But if it comes out on Oculus and then it comes out on Steam VR, that would cover most of every platform in some respect.
Do you reckon you'll pick it up and have a look?
It depends on the price. I wouldn't imagine it with that pricey. There's already a DJing app where you can virtual DJ, and you can meet up with other people and get one-to-one coaching from professional DJs within the VR space.
That's pretty cool.
So it's quite feasible that you can actually utilize these things. So it's an interesting option because, I mean, you know, the worst way, if the app is, let's say, for instance, and this is quite expensive for a VR app, you know, $29.99, it's still $29.99.
Yeah, it's not a lot.
Between 10 and 20 actual virtual instruments that you can sort of, you know, pick up and play around with.
And, do you see that kind of thing ever sort of entering the slightly more pro world? I mean, there's things like, you know, all the various mobile DAWs, Cubasis and the like. They've grown pretty well with the power of the hardware, so they're becoming a more serious option as well as the growth in the market for mobile interfaces, class-compliant interfaces. They're slowly becoming more relevant for the mobile music creator. You reckon VR's ever going to hit in a big way?
Well, possibly. It depends on the level of quality, the level of realism that it aspires to. I mean, the word on the street, the sort of amongst the sort of the tech columnists and the tech podcast types is that, and I think this is, I don't know if it was a Bloomberg announcement or something, you know, quite official. The word was that Apple working on their own VR solution.
It's going to be horrifyingly expensive.
It's going to be eye-wateringly expensive. So,
of course.
I think that, I mean, from what I was hearing, and I don't know how factual this is, there was to be a limited run of 200,000 units.
It's not a massive
amount
for Apple.
Very specialist, but it was a kind of teaser into, and Apple have got a history of doing this sort of thing. I mean, in fact, to be honest, Microsoft have, because they've got the HoloLens, which was quite prohibitively expensive. It was certainly in excess of $2,000. If not more, but I think they put this type of equipment out to inspire developers and get the conversation going and see, because a lot of people are suggesting that AR, augmented reality, is the future beyond VR.
Yeah.
So where you're looking in the real world, but you have graphical overlay, let's say. So, you know, you're walking down the street and there's sort of bubbles coming out of people's heads saying who they are and, you know, all that information that floats around us, you know, that's been shared between our mobile phones and the masks and all that we can't see, it's made real in front of us.
Yeah.
Which will be quite eerie because people will realise how much we're tracked and so forth.
Definitely. I know, obviously, you're a fan of Tested. Did you catch that video that I think Norm put up recently with a prototype of that one sort of digital photo framey type thing, but it's that glasses-less 3D holographic display?
Yes, I did. It was their second or third incarnation of it, and I was almost tempted to order it.
Oh, really?
It was almost within, I think it was something like, it was under $300, I believe.
Oh, no way.
And
that is good.
I was sorely tempted. I thought, should I order one? I think the thing's still open. The crowdfunding site for that is maybe still around. But I mean, again, they were talking to the developers because it was quite a long video, and I would imagine it's another sort of I don't know, stepping stone towards the end goal of sort of holographic television.
Yeah,
possibly, because they were able to animate, weren't they, with it? There's animations that you can load into it.
And I remember on maybe the first prototype where it had sort of cameras and things built into the display so you can interact with it as well. It was really cool bit of technology, even if us mere mortals can only experience it through the magic of YouTube and frustratingly 2D.
Well, the original one was quite pricey, but it was but this one was definitely, I'm sure it's $299 or something like
really
that.
Really impressive.
Might have been slightly less. So it was in the, I mean, it's not throwaway money, but it was the sort of thing I was thinking, oh, but I'm very allergic to going too quickly with, I mean, there's nothing wrong with being an early adopter, but you can get into things a bit too early. And that's what happened to me in the past, where I've got a bit overexcited about something and stepped into something and invested. Typically, you don't get the best because you need the technology to mature for a time, and also you tend to pay through the nose.
Yeah,
you tend to pay the premium prices, but obviously it's understandable because they need those funds to keep the development going. I mean, typically I think my first Oculus headset, in fact my development kit was reasonably inexpensive, but the consumer version, the first one, I think once I bought the handsets I'd spent nearly £1,000, whereas my last one that I bought was £299 all in with everything.
Yeah, and that was the Quest, wasn't it? Quest 2.
And it's substantially better.
Yeah.
So, it just shows you, and that's in a period of under 5 years, so things can move along quite quickly. It's not like you're waiting forever. But I did the same thing with the old quadcopters, you know, the drones.
Yeah.
I stepped in too early with that and spent quite a lot of that, and that was early on when you had to the drones typically came as kits and you had to build them. I should have waited and hung back. I mean, I think that particular technology has matured quite well. It's just that, you know, I know they're not sort of, there's not a new drone every year. I mean, there are, you know, there's the odd one, but it's not like they're coming out like iPhones or something that there's a new incarnation. It seems to have slowed up a bit. It's kind of got to a, I don't know, optimal level. I'm sure they're going to make more jumps. And I think mainly the development now is not so much the hardware, it's the software and the coding. A bit like robotics.
Autonomy and things, yeah.
Yes, it's a bit like the... what's it? The company that does all the robots. They've got the robot dog that escapes me. The DARPA.
Boston Dynamics.
Yes, exactly. So... essentially the Atlas robots and the dog, I can't remember the dog's
Spot.
name, but the Atlas robot, there was a recent video with the Atlas robots sort of dancing in sort of all different ways, and I think essentially the robot is the same robot, it's the development of the firmware and the software and the programming that really has the stuff that you can't see that's come a long way.
Totally. I mean, it's something that is quite nice while we're all kind of stuck at home twiddling our thumbs. We do get to observe this technology advancing. And I think that, that holographic display, as well as VR, good ones to keep an eye on.
And it's not always easy to predict which is going to take off. You think, well, that's great.
No,
and then suddenly
all.
it's a gateway into some other technology. And that secondary technology is the one that actually becomes sort of commonplace. And as I say, I think it's going to be not VR necessarily, although I love VR, it's going to be AR, augmented reality. Mm. And we're seeing it quite extensively in lots of cars now. They're sort of projecting into the windscreen and projecting all sorts of... important information about the driving conditions and traffic and so forth.
Totally. Time to approach the stars with
Luke's Spacey Bit.
Good evening or good day, space fans. My name is Luke, and welcome to the Spacey Bit. I'm going to talk to you about two interesting things. On Sunday, the 24th of January 2021, SpaceX broke the record for the highest number of individual satellites in a payload, launching 143 small spacecraft from their Falcon 9 rocket. The launch is an example of their rideshare platform dubbed Transporter 1, which demonstrates their payload delivery service to Earth orbit as a consumer product. The commercial satellites come from many customers that include maritime navigation services, emergency service locator satellites, weather forecasting systems, and even tiny CubeSat testbeds from NASA themselves. Perhaps just as interesting is the Falcon 9 rocket that SpaceX used for this mission. This particular booster, designated B1058, flew for the first time on the Crew Dragon Demo 2 mission to deliver astronauts to the ISS in May 2020. It was the first time that humans had been launched in a commercial spacecraft, and it was also the first time that Americans returned to the ISS on a spacecraft other than the Soyuz since the discontinuation of the Space Shuttle program. The Transporter 1 mission marks its fifth successful launch, and landing on the company's seafaring recovery ship, Of Course I Still Love You, which, by the way, is humorously named after an eccentric AI starship from Ian M. Banks' Culture series. The other drone recovery ship is called Just Read the Instructions, similarly named from that same series. A persistent joke in the Culture series is that these ships are not named anything particularly grandiose or grandeur, which a lot of the Culture's opponents take to be a sort of slight in that they don't take themselves seriously enough for ships as powerful as what they possess. It's a good series. I thoroughly recommend you read it. For this next part, I want to dive into relativity, so I apologize in advance. To be specific, we are going to discuss Einstein-Rosen bridges, more commonly known as wormholes, the stuff of science fiction, but for how much longer? So let's back up and clarify something. Do wormholes actually exist? Well, the answer is that they probably do, because they were predicted by Albert Einstein and Nathan Rosen in 1935. I say this because the same body of work also predicted the existence of black holes, which we have now discovered direct evidence of. The first picture of a black hole was released in 2019 after it was captured and compiled by the Event Horizon Telescope. The novel image was taken from a galaxy called Messier 87, or M87 for short, some 55 million light-years away from us, and provides a glimpse at a black hole, showing the theorized event horizon and accretion disk. It turns out that the visual effects used to depict the black hole in the movie Interstellar were pretty accurate and show the lensing effect that the tremendous inescapable gravity well of a black hole has on light and matter that is drawn near to it. So we know that black holes exist. It follows, therefore, that if the math checks out for them, then we can bet that we might also live in a universe that contains wormholes. This is also depicted in the film Interstellar. I thoroughly recommend watching it if you haven't seen it. The mathematical model used to create the black hole visual effects actually received some scientific accolades due to its accuracy. It was reportedly used in 2 research papers. Now in the film, not to give away too many spoilers, but basically something crazy happens inside the black hole that allows our hero to further the narrative of the movie. In reality, Einstein-Rosen bridges or wormholes may exist inside black holes because the sheer weight of the black hole causes space-time to bend and shorten the relative distance between 2 points. This is hard to imagine, I know, but it's thought to be possible. If they were to exist, it is likely that they only allow the transmission of small, high-energy particles to flow across the quote-unquote bridge. Sending a human or spacecraft through would remain in the realm of science fiction, unless we can define a way to force a wormhole to open wider. But this is really so far beyond our current engineering ability that the point is fairly moot. Insofar as detecting wormholes, some progress has been made, and that's the crux of what I'm talking about today. A paper was published last year by Russian astronomers from the Central Astronomical Observatory at Pulkovo in St. Petersburg. They propose that some active galactic nuclei may be wormholes rather than supermassive black holes, and that such wormholes would emit gamma radiation as a result of a collision of particles leaving the wormhole. They say that this radiation has a distinctive spectrum, much different from those jets or accretion disks of active galactic nuclei. An observation of such radiation would serve as evidence for the existence of a wormhole. When I read this through for the first time on the paper, I didn't quite understand. I thought that they were saying that active galactic nuclei were not wormholes, but I think the point they're making is that if active galactic nuclei were supermassive black holes, they would look a different way to what they theorize the radiation coming out of a wormhole would look like. So I'm going to go with that interpretation. So there you have it, that's the hypothesis. Only time will tell and observations made will ratify their claims, but certainly it is exciting to know that this is being worked on by astronomers. The existence of astronomical wormholes may serve to explain the quantum teleportation phenomenon that we are looking into here on Earth, but that's a topic for another time. It's a very big topic as well. It's commonly said on the internet that if you think you understand quantum mechanics, you don't. So if you have anything to discuss regarding space, synthesizers, music, games, or trivia, please feel free to contact us via all the modern methods. That's it for our segment, so I'll return you to my co-hosts. Stay safe, and bye-bye.
Thank you once again, Luke. Always a pleasure. That rounds us up. We're going to hit the end. The multimedia recommendation that I never remember the name of. Pete, I think... Well, you definitely recommended this to me. I don't know if you recommended it on the podcast, but Abroad in Japan. You definitely recommended him, I believe.
Yeah, I've done him.
Mm-hmm.
Have you been getting into him?
Exactly. I've been binging the videos. I am enjoying his personality. So
he's got a really it's quite a nice dry humor he's got to him.
Definitely.
It's sort of a decent self-deprecating and a decent amount of sarcasm.
Yeah, it's just reassuringly English. Makes me think of home.
Yeah.
But my actual recommendation for this week will be 3-minute board games. If you want reviews of board games, there's a really good series by the channel, 3-minute board games. Reviews in 3 minutes, super thorough, really detailed. The people behind it have a wealth of experience in playing, collecting, reviewing, etc. board games. If you're looking for some new things, obviously we need something to you know, occupy ourselves with at the moment. 3-minute board games, if you're into that sort of thing, that might find you the next one. What have you got for us, Pete?
As is the norm with me, it's a YouTube recommendation. Mm. This is one that would should be especially interesting to Luke. It's primarily centering on astrophysics, and the name of the channel is Event Horizon.
Classic.
So they're, again, these are, well, some of them are, they do extended ones where it's more like a podcast type of format, but there are some graphics, and they will get on, or the host will get on quite leading astrophysicists who really know their stuff, or they'll do sort of shorter ones, but they generally are sort of interesting topics. So Luke does his sort of spacey bit, which is what, 5 minutes or so. They'll tackle the same sort of subjects, but they'll stretch it out, and it can be up to sort of an hour generally. And they sort of, without getting boring, but they do get into it quite deeply. So it's all the sort of current stuff that is being discovered or being announced, and then they'll dip into other bits and pieces. So searching for alien megastructures.
Ooh, excellent.
And then they'll get some qualified. So it won't be some conspiracy theory type person. It'll be a proper sort of professor or doctor from a recognised university talking about what we actually know. And they don't get into the sort of really sort of hairy fairy stuff. It's all sort of this is what we know, this is a possibility, but we're not saying that's actually a thing. But it's there was quite an interesting one in it. I don't know if you're familiar with the item that passed through our solar system in 2018 that got everyone excited.
Not at all.
Call them a object came into our solar system from is it a bleak angle? So if you can imagine our solar system, it's in a flat plane with all the planets flying around the sun or orbiting around the sun. This thing came down from the top.
Ooh,
from a deep space, and then sort of did a sort of little slingshot round the sun, but came quite close to, relatively close to Earth. I mean, not sort of so close that it'd be dangerous, but it sort of came into the inner solar system, and then its trajectory was slightly bent by the sun, and it went off again. And it's the first recorded interstellar object that's come from outside the solar system.
Definitely,
and
cool.
It was they gave it the moniker of Muamua, which is Hawaiian for I don't know, but something like stranger or something like, I can't remember what it was for, but anyway, so it was called a Muamua, and they were able to calculate initially, because of the reflected light, that they felt it was about 50 meters long, but long like a cigar shaped thing.
Oh yeah,
so think Arthur C. Clarke, Rendezvous from Rama.
Oh yeah, nice.
So
one.
Now they've done further analysis, they think it might have been dish shaped.
Okay.
So the speculation, and this is not just this is obviously just speculation, but it's not impossible. They think it could have been a solar sail or something like that.
A fragment of a craft from somewhere.
Yes, exactly. So they're saying that it's not inconceivable. They're not saying it is, but it's not inconceivable that it could have been of alien, but manufactured alien origin, because obviously anything that comes out from the solar system is alien, but not alien in the respect of creatures, but alien because it's from elsewhere.
Yeah, amazing. Well, if our friend Luke has successfully whet your appetite for spacey goodness, Event Horizon sounds like a good one.
Yes,
lovely stuff. Thank you as always for listening to Rack Addicts After Hours. We've been Pete and Ben of Rack Addicts UK. Thank you very much, and we do hope you tune in next week. Goodbye.